Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, our brains, when faced with kind of unexplained observations, will develop an explanation, nevertheless, usually compatible with our current beliefs. For example, in the past, we thought that people with seizures were possessed by demons and schizophrenia was blamed on poor mothering. With time, better evidence, and reasoning, these explanations proved incorrect, and better explanations came about. So we need evidence and reasoning to produce a more accurate understanding of how things really work, and keeping an open mind about what we believe today is prudent, especially if you want to understand what is correct. Today, there are numerous explanations about how to maintain our brains as we age. But what is the evidence for what really works? Our guest today is Dr. John Medina, and our topic is his latest book, Brain Rules for Aging Well, 10 Principles for Staying Vital, Happy, and Sharp. Dr. Medina is a developmental and molecular biologist focused on genes involved with human brain development and genetics of psychiatric disorders, and he spent most of his professional life as a private research consultant, primarily in biotechnology and pharmaceutical industries, but he's also an affiliate professor of bioengineering at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He's written numerous books, including the New York Times bestseller Brain Rules. Then he had Brain Rules for Baby, and this current one, Brain Rules for Aging Well. He has several other books, and he's been recognized by students for his unique teaching talents. Welcome to Line One, Dr. Medina.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I look forward to this, and let me remind listeners right off the bat, you can reach us with questions and comments in Anchorage. Our number to get a hold of us during the next hour is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So often these programs start with a little bit of information, so tell us a little bit about what you're doing in your day job and how you got into writing books for the public consumption, I think, primarily, it looks like.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, my research career has been in two buckets, I guess. First of all, like you said, I'm a private analytical research consultant. Much of my research career has been spent parachuting into projects in biotech and pharmaceutical industries and try to poke holes in it if I can, and then or give my commentary about how the research is headed and whatnot. I perform a very similar function in the Department of Bioengineering, where I am an affiliate professor, and that's part of it. But the other part of it actually comes from an observation. You know, the money that we get in our department is primarily federal money. It's money that has been given to us by the taxpayers, by you guys. And, you know, we have, I think, an obligation, mostly because we don't do this very well, but we need to learn how to communicate the information we get from the money we are given by you, you know, to you. So I think we owe it to you to tell you what it is we're doing. So I've spent about half of my career now trying to figure out ways to communicate what we molecular biologists, in this case brain scientists and neuroscientists in general, are actually doing with the taxpayer money, mostly because I think we're obligated for it. So it's in two components. I do a fair amount of research, and I do a fair amount of teaching. Your standard issue professor.
Well, that's a remarkably important way to think about things. I've never really thought about that aspect of what others like you might be doing. So congratulations and thanks for doing that.
Well, don't you think we owe you?
Yeah. In a sense, yes. And at the same time, it kind of gets to my point in the introduction is, how do we know what's good? We're getting bombarded with information. Information is easier to get now than it's ever been. Yeah. And at the same time, I've come to appreciate that psychology has really come of age recently, and we're beginning to understand better and better what's wrong with our brains. We all assume that we are pretty smart, usually always right. It turns out, you know, our memories aren't so good. We have lots of biases. We figure things out and explain things as I started based on some previous beliefs. And a lot of that stuff just is wrong. So what are your thoughts about all that?
Oh, I have a whole lot of thoughts about that, Pat. I think the one of the biggest, if I had my druthers, mostly because I will see people will go on the internet and then see all kinds of, I'm just going to use the word fake or spurious or whatever, and what seems to be commonly lacking is an understanding of the statistical knowledge that it would be required to understand a particular piece of data. So here I have a wish, if I could. If I could wave a magic wand over the internet and the people that use it, including myself, I would say that you would have to have a license before you could get on the internet. And you know what that license would consist of? Getting a course in statistics. Because as soon as you begin to understand exactly how data is derived, particularly if you're working with human behavior, so you're looking at behaviors like the biases that you were describing, or how to understand what a study, scientific study says and what it doesn't, if you have a fairly a robust background in just the most basic levels of statistics, you're going to be able to make a much more informed decision over what it is that you're reading or what it is that you choose to consume, or even better, what you choose to deputize as truth, than you would if you didn't have that statistical understanding. If you don't have that understanding, all you've got is an opinion.
In addition to the statistic, and yeah, I agree with that, by the way, before I make this other comment, is that I often have patients who tell me, I've done my research on the internet, and I don't roll my eyes, but I say, wow, you know, there are people who spend their whole lives learning how to really do, analyze information correctly, and that information is available, but it is it is hard to do it really well.
Well, if you have a value system that includes truth with either a small t or a capital T, but if truth means something to you, you owe it to yourself to have a great exploration as to what you have chosen to consume, what you've chosen to swallow. And if indeed it's just, you know, we were talking off the air that much of my career has been spent teaching biologists how to do math. But the reason why that turns out to be fairly important is because you can begin to believe things that are not correct and yet still believe them. A good one is correlation and causation. It is not true that a correlation means a causation. Statistics don't apply to individuals. They apply to groups. If you see one particular piece of data, the first question you should ask is, gee, isn't that interesting data? Where did that come from? Your first question should be, has somebody else replicated this study? Hopefully in a non-competing laboratory, found the exact same results and published it accordingly. If you don't have that level of rigor associated with what your point of view is, particularly in the biological sciences, you probably do not have as strong a love affair with truth as you might normally need to be. And the only thing that's required is to dust off the old memory cells of mathematics and understand a little bit of statistics, for which there are tremendous numbers of programs on the internet for it, in order for you to understand and have an ability to grapple with the things you are choosing to consume.
Along the same lines, in the information I sent you about today's program and links that are on our website for today's program, I put down some information that I was first brought to by reading Carl Sagan, where he has the baloney detection kit and Shermer's suggestions for baloney detection. We're talking about basically the difference between Shermer was really talking about pseudoscience and science, which and pseudoscience is really permeates a lot of the misinformation out there. Is that important for people to perhaps at least be aware of and think about as they look at sites and information and read books and so forth?
Oh, I think everybody, particularly if you're into behavior, should read The Demon-Haunted World. That's, I think, isn't that the book that Carl Sagan wrote that triggered the Pulitzer?
Yes.
It's a great treatise on what critical thinking is and what it isn't. What it does is that it has a tendency to calm you down as long as you are willing to have the humility when you approach it to say, you know, I feel strongly about this, but it may not be right. Let's see what is right and what is wrong and begin the, it would be a lay audience penetration, but a real one. My normal suggestion for people that would really like to follow this line of rigor is to read books by authors who are themselves established scientists. Many of them have gotten much better at being, I guess what is the word, translatable, clear, not opaque. And that's often a really, really good indicator as to whether you're going to be in the right ballpark with a particular issue or not, particularly if that scientist has written about some of their own work, some of their own discoveries. Carl Sagan's a great example of one for astrophysics. There's a guy named Joseph Ledoux, who's a terrific neuroscientist and has written a number of books on the stuff that he's done. There's another one by Robert Sapolsky. He's probably one of the world's greatest authorities on stress. And so if you're interested in understanding how your brain responds to stress and its relationship to anxiety disorders and depression, you know, you might pick up a copy of Robert Sapolsky's Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. That's literally the title of it, Pat.
Yep.
And I start to imbibe that as a regular part of the diet that you're consuming when you're looking at data.
One more mention of another book, and I hate to do it to you, but I want to see if you are aware of it, but I also want to make sure our listeners are aware of it, and that's a book I came across recently called Denying to the Grave, Why We Ignore Facts That Will Save Us, which is really a hard look at how we can be fooled by bias, emotions over evidence, and charismatic leaders. And it makes the point that, you know, when we're making decisions, particularly about health, we are making potentially life-changing, life-altering, and we better think about getting it right.
Yeah. Oh, I think so. And the ability to understand how science is done and how it's not done. A lot of people, I found, Dr. Woodward, are threatened by science. And I can't tell you the number of parties that I've been to where I tell people what I do for a living, and then I just see their eyes glaze over, or they leave. And I think to myself, what did I do wrong? Some people are really threatened by it. So even, a beginning process might be understanding why that might be a threat to you. What I've often discovered is that somebody has not done very well in school in a particular subject, maybe a science subject, maybe a math subject. Years and years and years ago, that failure occurred. Yet it still has echoes on even as adults. And so they become defensive over something, mostly because of a reaction to something that happened a long time ago. And my normal response to that is, well, you know, there's a lot of people that don't do well at math and science at first, but all they need is to get up to speed, is to get a good book and start understanding it, and that stuff gets healed over pretty quickly. My favorite example of this, Thad, is E.O. Wilson. Are you familiar with E.O. Wilson?
I am, yes.
He's a hero of mine, I have to say. An entomologist, for those of you who have not seen E.O. Wilson, he's written lots of books. He's an ant expert, but he's really a terrific scientist. Biophilia, he's known for. He's the first to say he sucks at math, at least he did for a while. And yet, Thad, he's brilliant. He's a pole star for me and maybe for you too. I know a lot of my colleagues love E.O. Wilson's point of view. And it's the point of view of the collision between Karl Popper and Francis Bacon, what's called the scientific method. And he's very much, he approaches it with enough humility to say, yeah, you know, I've not been very good quantitatively, so I had to get up to speed in order for me to be able to do this stuff. Well, if E.O. Wilson can do it, you can too. As can anybody. It's just a matter of having the will, I guess.
I think, again, I hate to keep going, but I think it brings up the point that's been said a lot, is that the way we teach science is we're memorizing, you know, facts and stuff. And really, science is solving problems and asking questions and realizing levels of evidence, which does, unfortunately, get you into statistics and math. That's what science is really all about. It's somewhat of a creative endeavor.
Well, it is, and in fact, it is proper to use the word scientists spend a lot of time in what I call guess land, hypothesis land. They're making, you know, they're speculating on what they think is occurring, and then have devised an experiment or a series of logical steps to see if the hypothesis, the guess, was true or not. The power of that model is that it is it's extraordinarily humiliating, okay? Because, you know, I've had a pretty good career, but 50% of the time, Thad, I am wrong.
Sure, yeah.
So my guess is, but every time I am wrong, though, I end up learning something new out of it, and that just then produces more hypotheses, and pretty soon.
Right.
You know, this is such a natural way to think. I know you're a pediatrician, and when I wrote Brain Rules for Baby, one of the first things that began to be clear is that babies naturally hypothesis test. Nobody teaches them how to do it. They do it all over the world. We actually think this whole idea of learning through a series of increasingly corrected ideas is an innate feature of human beings' cognitive potential.
Good point. Yes, I've heard that before, and that's a very good point. So somehow we get taught not to do that. Right?
There you go.
All right. Well, let me remind listeners, this is Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. John Medina. We're talking about his most recent book, Brain Rules for Aging Well. If you've got questions or comments, you can call us in the next 45 minutes, 550-8433. Our email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. We also have the toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. So let's go to your book, and let's start by talking about longevity. I love when you were interviewed by Ginger Campbell talking about what longevity is and life expectancy and how DNA gets involved and what happens after middle age to explain why we can't probably live forever, at least as we understand things now. Put that in perspective for us.
Well, you bet. We'll start with some definitions, as I was talking with Ginger about, because people get these terms confused. Longevity, life expectancy, lifespan. So let's go through those. Longevity is the amount of time you can spend on the planet if conditions were ideal. You know, if you didn't get into any accidents, if you never ran across a virus, if you never had anything wrong happen to you, longevity is the amount of time you're going to spend here before the wheels come off and you die. For human beings, we think it's somewhere between 114 and 122 years were the conditions ideal. So that's longevity. Life expectancy, which you can interchange with lifespan, different researchers in different laboratories actually have different ways they measure it. That's the amount of time you can spend on the planet, given that conditions are almost never ideal. So if you are in a place where there's a lot of viruses and a lot of bacteria, you're going to get sick and die much earlier than somebody that's not living in that space. If you're in a place where there's lots of war, you're going to die much sooner than if you were in a place with not lots of war. Places where you get lots of accidents, we've got an endoskeleton, so you just have to drop a meter, you can crack your head open and die. You know, these are not ideal conditions, Thad.
Yep.
And life expectancy, or lifespan, is that number. For hundreds of thousands of years, most of us, our life expectancy was about 30 years of age. We'd live till we were 30, and then we were dead. Thomas Hobbes was right when he said the natural state of man was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. In fact, that number from about Paleolithic times up until about the 18th century or so, average lifespan was about 33 years. It's only been really recently that we've been able to regularly get much older. Our lifespan is increasing, actually moving up to that probably longevity maximum of 114 to 122 years. By 1950, the average was still around 48 years of age before you died. Now it's 72, 76, 78, depending upon lots of factors, including your gender. You can live for 7 or 8 decades on this planet in relatively good health. So life expectancy is like an accordion. It moves and can expand or contract depending upon conditions. Longevity is probably a comment on our DNA.
And our DNA is replicating hundreds of thousands of times, maybe more than that. I don't know the right number. And it makes some mistakes. And you make a good point about, at least with regards to the brain, we can stay there. There becomes a rate-limiting time when things start falling apart slowly.
Yeah. You're making mistakes all the time in your DNA. The DNA, you actually get a lot of damage in your DNA. But up until around age, anywhere between 20 and 30 years of age, your ability to repair those mistakes keeps up with the rate of mistakes, if that makes sense. So you're constantly screwing something up, but you're constantly repairing something. And for about your first 2 or 3 decades of life, those numbers are fairly equal. In fact, I would argue that it's on the better side of repair. As soon as a mistake is made, it's absolutely repaired, and then you are healthy for a while. That all begins to change. In fact, it probably begins to change between the ages of 25 and 30. That's when we're at our maximum. After around age 30, the repair mechanisms are not as good. They go to sleep. Maybe they retire early. They do lots of different things. In fact, what they're doing is that they're also getting damaged, just like the rest of your body is getting damaged. And after a while, around age 30, the equilibrium begins to shift. And now the mistakes that are being made are not as are not repaired as quickly. In some cases, not repaired at all. And so muscle fiber begins to change. Bones begin to demineralize. Neurons that you have in your brain, you never. There's only two places in the world where you could in the brain where you could actually reproduce them. You may be losing 20, 30,000 neurons a day. That begins to show up. And after that, you begin to show the signs of aging. But aging itself, which I would argue is a random process, is governed by something that is perhaps not random at all. It's just that the repair mechanisms have begun to go to sleep. Your maximum age, I'll just say cognitive potential, your brain is at its peak at around 23.86 years of age. After around age 24, it's all downhill from there. And after 30, it's really downhill.
What part is genetics?
Well, about 25% of the variance in human lifespan can be explained directly by how well you chose your parents. So 25% of how long you're going to live, there's a contribution that can be made, can be explained by the genetic component. What that means is that 75% of the variance in human lifespan is directly related to your lifestyle. The lifestyle choices you make produce a profound effect over how long you're going to live. Maybe even how long, maybe if you can approach that longevity maximum, fully depends on how good you're taking care of yourself. And in fact, that's the reason why I wrote the book. At 75%, there are tons of things. As long as you stay away from the mythologies, stay away from the things that are just not statistically supported, not reproduced, and stuff we were just talking about for the last 10 minutes. If you stay for that, there are many things you can do. In fact, I think there are 12 to 13 things altogether, codified them into a series of brain rules, about 10 of them, that you can responsibly do right now to make your lifespan begin to approach your longevity.
All right, so let's start into some of these individual chapters and topics in. I want to start with nutrition. My sure. feeling about nutrition is there's a lot of misinformation. Again, yeah. If we want to do the right thing, we have limited amount of resources, limited amount of time. We need to make sure we're getting the best information. It's one of the reasons you're on this program. Tell us about nutrition and nurturing our brains.
Sure. For the longest time, I stayed completely away from nutrition research, I have to tell you, so I have a bias here. The reason why is that a lot of it is, the word isn't sloppy, it's just that the field is so hard to do responsibly, and it's so underfunded. You know, when you eat something, those are complex chemicals, and when you put it into your body, there are all kinds of complex biochemical processes that work with it. There are so many uncontrolled variables or unknown variables that you often got really, I'm going to use the word contradictory stuff. So I stayed away from it for the longest time. I've written 10 books. Brain Rules for Aging Well is the first of those 10 where I ever actually put nutrition research into it. And the reason why is that there are some stuff that can at least withstand what is sometimes called the Medina grump factor in places where I work, because I tend to be fairly grumpy about this stuff. And it's very simple and it's very specific. It's the Mediterranean diet, which improves executive function in the human brain, which I can unpack, especially working memory. That you can say, you can bring that home to the bank. That's not an opinion. Everybody should be eating a Mediterranean diet if they want to improve their brain. So, shall we unpack that a little bit?
Absolutely.
Alrighty. Let's start with executive function, because that's the cognitive gadget that is most affected by Mediterranean diets. And then I'll talk about the Mediterranean diet. Executive function, you can think of it as a bridge with two piers. One of them is called cognitive control. This is the ability to focus on a particular item in your worldview, or the ability to understand how to make a heuristic, a hierarchical heuristic. And by that I mean, if you've got a ton of variables, you could put it into a gist to detail very quickly. For example, if you had this gigantic net full of fish, you could almost, if you have good executive function, you can immediately begin sorting by size or by color or by species, that kind of thing. That's called cognitive control. The other pier of executive function is called emotional regulation. I like to call it impulse control. This is the ability to not punch somebody in the nose, even if you feel like it. Executive function, though, with both of those, is also involved in something we used to call short-term memory. Alan Badley has a better term for it. We call it working memory. But it's the same idea, that there's a volatile buffer inside your head that will take pieces of information for a period of time and hold it there, resident for an hour or two. You want to have strong executive function, especially as you get older, because it actually begins to erode. So the question you can ask is, what can improve executive function, particularly working memory, that short-term memory stuff? And now, Thad, I can say something. Yeah, in real-life, peer-reviewed work replicated lots of different times. It's the Mediterranean diet. The Mediterranean diet was so named because of this is the kinds of things that is eaten all around the rim of the Mediterranean, particularly southern Europe and northern Africa. Here's what it is. Every fruit and vegetable you can think of, and all the time. If you're going to eat a protein, it should be chicken or white meat of some kind. Fish is a good example. If you're going to have oil, make sure that it's olive oil, not other types of oil, particularly oil that is derived from animals. Make sure that it's olive oil, and you can have lots of nuts all day long with that, too. So lots of fruits, lots of vegetables, lots of nuts. If it's going to be oil, it needs to be olive oil and white meat, particularly chicken and fish. And I know that sounds boring. And one of the reasons why it's hard for me to say this, but I am the perfect person to say it, is because I love barbecued ribs. I love a good cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. You know, I would IV French fries if I could. And I can't do that anymore. If I want to improve, I'm 62, and if I want to keep my working memory strong, and thank God it still is, and if I want to keep my executive function, because as a scientist, I need to have that, you know what's upstairs in my refrigerator? It's a freaking chicken. I don't think I've had a rib in 6 months, and I'll have to tell you that, but that is a grievous thing for me to have to tell you.
So is the Mediterranean diet and other diets that are quite similar, you mentioned some other ones, in one other one in particular, the MIND diet in your book.
The MIND diet, for sure.
Is it that that is something special, or is it helping our brain because we're in the habit of eating so much other stuff that's so bad for our brain?
Well, probably all of the above.
Yeah, or all of the above. Yeah, that's the other answer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there are probably several components to it. We're in just the beginning stages of understanding exactly what these types of diets do to us. One of them is that it appears to lower systemic inflammation throughout the body, and that includes in the brain. If you are inflaming parts of the brain, you are inflaming there's something called myelin that's in the brain. You can think of that as the insulation, like insulation that's wrapped around a wire, only this is a fatty tissue. And if you inflame the brain, you can destroy parts of that. And if you destroy some white matter, because it's insulating, if you've got a nerve that's got white matter on it, you can send out a signal at about 100 meters per second. But if you destroy the insulation, now that signal will only go out at about 1 meter per second, which means the less insulation you have in certain areas of the brain, the less efficient the brain works. Well, if inflammation is going to be attacking the insulation, just stop doing the things that cause the inflammation, and one of those is diet. Here's another one that we haven't talked about yet. We now know that a very particular type of experience of loneliness, of social isolation, can also produce inflammation throughout the body. And so we are now beginning to understand it's not just what you put in your mouth that is important for maintaining brain health. It's how many friends you have and how many social interactions and socially connected you feel per unit time. Both are very strong components of having a healthy brain lifestyle as you begin to get older. It's really weird to say this, Dad, but it's coming from the research literature itself. Mm-hmm. The more friends you have, the better your brain works. The less friends you have and the more cranky you decide to be, the less number of friends you're going to have and the less well your brain works.
All right. Well, I definitely have a couple of other questions. We have some callers, and I want to get into the socialization, but maybe I spent too much time on the science stuff, but I need to take a break. Then we got about 30 minutes left, and we'll go into that. So let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break, and we'll continue this discussion on brain rules for aging well with Dr. John Medina. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're discussing the best evidence for caring and nurturing your brain with Dr. John Medina. He's the author of a series of books, Brain Rules, on Brain Rules, the most recent being Brain Rules for Aging Well, 10 Principles for Staying Vital, Happy, and Sharp. You can email questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Call us locally at 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And just as you heard, remember between 8 and 9, if you're listening locally anyway, you're listening to a rebroadcast and we won't be able to take your calls. And please take a look at our website at alaskapublic.org. Find the Line 1 link and see today's program notes. There's a number of links to information about and books that we're talking about today. I have a number of callers that have called in about science, and I really hate to do this, but I'm probably going to hold on those. I want to get through as much on the book as we can. Don't hang up if you don't have to. If we get time, we'll get to some of those. But I think it's most importantly the topic today is our health and what we can do about, as I said, nurturing our brain. So you've mentioned the diet is important. Another thing that seems to be very important to me is talking about taking vitamins and supplements as opposed to what we eat. Is that important? And what do we know?
I would stay away from supplements. In fact, the body has lots of thermostats, unless you're under doctor's orders to do something, mm-hmm. for sure. Then that's going to trump everything I'm about to say. But the reason why I say it's much better if you can get those vitamins from naturally occurring foods, like stuff that you grow in your own garden or stuff that you raise, is because that's, from an evolutionary perspective, that's how it is that we got it. We never got tons of vitamin A all at once and then put it into our system. If you get too much vitamin A, you're just going to pee it out. In fact, the quip is that Americans have the most expensive urine in the world because so many of them take the supplements that the body actually doesn't need. It would be much better if you could get it naturally. So if you're doing your homework and you're eating lots of fruits and lots of vegetables, and there's so many nutrients inside those things, in your chicken and your olive oil, that you stand a really good chance of having a balanced diet in the ways that, from an evolutionary perspective, your body was actually designed to handle it, much better than taking these giant blast radiuses of supplements that the body often does not quite know what to do with and so ends up rejecting or storing it in the liver.
What about calories? What about calorie restriction? What about over calories, harms, benefits? What would you say?
Well, I'd say probably your 2,000 calorie limit is that's a good speed limit to have. You can, if you follow the work, the guy's name was George Martin, who originally did this work, was the first to show that if you undergo calorie restriction in laboratory animals, you can get changes in their lifespan. They tend to approach their longevity better if you keep them starved, their longevity maximum, much better if you keep them on a calorie-restricted diet. And he would play with different numbers, and there's no real set number except to say less calories than you usually need. He has created, and others that have done this work, have created a gigantic cautionary sign. Don't do this. The best thing that you can do is to eat a balanced diet in the calories that you need, and if you are going to undergo a weight loss program, for heaven's sakes, do it with a physician to make sure that the calorie restrictions you're undergoing are medically supervised. Because if you do what George did in the laboratory, and you're a human being that actually has certain medical issues, you can actually hurt yourself badly if you do undergo calorie restriction without it being supervised. So eating less calories is probably a good idea. If you want to do the longevity thing, I mean, that data are actually out there. It's real stuff. But you need to do it in a supervised way.
All right. I'm going to take a caller. Rachel, you're on line one. You have a question about some oil, and since we're on the topic of food, and then I'm going to move on to some of the socialization issues. Rachel, what can we do for you?
Okay. I am Alaska Native, and I belong to an elder program and for lunch. And I was taking olive oil and putting olive oil on my food to get the Mediterranean diet effect. But I found out that avocado oil is much better. It's not as bitter. And so instead of using seal oil, we're using avocado oil. On NPR this morning, they had leafy greens are the fountain of youth. Of leafy greens improve executive function over the long run.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's absolutely the case. If you have the choice of an animal-based oil or a plant-based oil is going to win every time. So if you have if you don't have access to the ones that have been tested and have undergone a fairly rigorous examination has been either the presence of olive oil or the absence of olive oil and the presence of animal. But if you have a choice between an animal-derived product and a leafy green-derived product or a plant-based product, I'd go with the plant every time.
Avocado oil mean anything special to you or don't know?
I haven't seen a lot of literature on most of the specialized oils. Like I say, this stuff, it's actually, Mediterranean diet's been around for a while, but in terms of being able to really understand how it does, how it works, people are really focusing on that to look at a molecular mechanism and have not branched out a whole lot into the other types of oils. One oil I've been looking at to see if there's been as much research on the olive oil are things like canola oil and other types of, if there are other plant-based oils that are going to be as effective as the olive oil. And yet, to date, I've not seen anything that would pass my grub factor there, Thad, so I'll just say, jury's out.
All right.
Nutrition doesn't pass my grub factor until this book.
Yeah. All right, well, I appreciate it. I've been very skeptical about nutritional information, and yet I continue to try to find the good stuff, but I don't have the time, and I certainly don't have the expertise you do. So I really, one of the reasons I appreciate your book. All right.
And I can say this also, on the website, brainrules.net, if they want to see the reference, it's a non-commercial website, just go on it. You can get the references yourself. Go onto the diet tab and then click on it, and the references will come up. And people can begin looking at the peer-reviewed work themselves so they can see the data in its rawest form.
Great idea. Thank you. All right, let's go to socialization. We're social animals, and there's apparently benefit if we stay social and not so good findings if we're not so social. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one study in particular, this has been replicated so many times, but this was measured over a 12-year period with about 1,100 seniors. Highest socializing group in those seniors, the rate of cognitive decline was 70% less than those who were not socializing very much. In that same group, memory decline was half that of the non-socializers. There are so many important aspects to having friends. And in fact, the data have even gotten granular. There is something called a productive engagement versus passive engagement I talk about. This is the work of Denise Parks and her Synapse Project, which is going to, she found a way for seniors to improve their memory, particularly what's called episodic memory, which is a memory for episodes. This is the type of memory that has a timestamp on it and characters. One study showed like a 100%, even a 600% increase. If you want to increase your episodic memory, this is what you do. You find a friend that is your friend and interact with them, just like I said, but make sure that friend disagrees with you on an important point and start arguing with that friend on a regular basis. No kidding. Mm-hmm. The ability to have, that's got to be friendly, Thad. You can't just go out there and bomb somebody, okay? In fact, the metaphor that I'm using is, I'm not sure if you remember the Supreme Court Justices, Antonin Scalia's relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They were both on the Supreme Court. Judge Scalia is dead now. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is politically in as far away from Antonin Scalia as could possibly be. And they would argue different points. You know, those arguments would had consequences for the United States. Yet they were extraordinarily good friends. They loved opera. They would go to the operas together. Ruth spoke at his funeral. In fact, it was the interactions were so powerful and so delightful, so intelligent, that a play was actually made about the interaction. That is a perfect metaphor for what I'm saying. Find a friend that you don't agree with and start arguing. Make sure it doesn't break the friendship. In the politically polarized world we're currently living in, I would consider that to be a risk. Nonetheless, you can improve your episodic memory substantially if in the midst of that relationship you're also doing a little tuggle with them. No kidding.
So that engages that socialization, taxes our working memory, or exercises it, if I could use the metaphor that you're so good at using metaphors in your book. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, well, what's happening is that human relationships take a tremendous amount of energy to maintain. We call it a cognitive load. I'm not sure if this has ever happened to you, Thad. You might have been in a social relationship, like at a party where you're seeing lots of people, and you love them, and you had a really great time. But when you get home, you are exhausted, and the only thing you want to do is stare out into space. Well, there's a reason for that. The big reason is that social relationships take a tremendous amount of energy, take a tremendous amount of concentration. In fact, you can think of it just with the word you're using. It's like getting a workout in the mental gym to interact with a friend or a group of friends. So we now know that that interaction is truly like a muscle, and the more you exercise the social muscle, the stronger your brain becomes, in such fashion that it actually buffers against the probability of you getting Alzheimer's disease. No kidding. So socialization turns out to be nearly as important as what I would argue is another physical aspect to do, and that is exercise. But socialization is extraordinarily important for brain health.
And we should maybe mention your brain gets an inordinate amount of your body's energy in what you're eating.
It's only 2% of your body weight, but it consumes 20 to 30% of your metabolizable food stuff.
Right. Okay.
And here's the interesting thing. It's got a sweet tooth. It does not metabolize fat. It only metabolizes sugar, interestingly enough. If you could, you know, if it could metabolize fat, if the brain could, you could literally lose weight by taking a calculus test or by going to a party where you've got all these social interactions. But it can't metabolize the fat. It can only metabolize the sugar. So it not only takes a tremendous amount of energy, it takes a tremendous amount of a particular energy to keep it running.
All right, I'm going to use the comment about metaphors. In the book, you use Seattle's infrastructure with the comparison of brain anatomy. You use the word cognitive six-pack talking about something. I want to use the term magic bullet and suggest that maybe, having reading your book, the magic bullet might be dancing, and would you correct me or explain why that might be?
Sure. This is a delightful series of research findings that have occurred, and it has three components to it. But let me give you the cliff notes, and then maybe we can talk about the components. Here it is. go dancing. Seniors should go dancing. Now, don't go dancing and go wiggling in front of somebody. You know? That's not dancing. It needs to be a ritualized motor movement with someone else. That doesn't involve you reliving the childish days of your youth. So ballroom dancing might be one of those. The reason why, you can show that if you go dancing, your posture and your balance improves by about 25%. This is critical for the senior population. You reduce the number of falls by 37%. That's probably a posture and balance related type. The effect sizes for certain types of these balances were almost 7 times greater with exercisers than with couch potatoes. And so the question was asked was, what is up with dancing? Because dancing, you could think of it as kind of a magic bullet. Why should seniors dance? We now know there are 3 reasons why seniors, there are 3 secret sauces, maybe that's the better way to say it, for dancing. Number one is exercise. When you're dancing, you're moving. So the heart rate is going to go up, and you're going to be moving your joints all around, and there's your balance. It turns out that if you can do aerobic exercises as seniors, you can increase greatly that executive function stuff we were talking about. So the exercise itself is good for the brain, and dancing is full of exercise. Number two, it's a social interaction. Yeah, one of the reasons why a lot of people don't like to dance anymore is because they're afraid of the social interactions. But it's the social interactions that produces a lot of the good stuff. So when you're dancing, you're not only moving in a ritualized fashion, you are also socially interacting with somebody in a what I'll call a mid-risk environment. The third, to me, is the heartbreaker. But it's important. It's been measured just like the aerobics and the social has been. You know, when I was researching for this book, beyond the stuff I normally do in the laboratory, my field research consisted of going out to assisted living centers and other. And I would ask 70-year-olds and 80-year-olds in wheelchairs and on couches, what was it like to grow old? And I would ask them what the good parts were, what the bad parts were. When we got to the bad parts, almost universally they said this: people treat me as if I were invisible. They don't touch me. They don't talk to me. They don't do anything with me except try and find somebody else who doesn't look like me. And my heart just broke sad when I would hear that. And where the research literature comes in is this: seniors don't get touched very often. When you get older, people stop touching you in a non-exploitive, non-sexual way. Just skin on skin, you know, a hug or a pat on the back or a regular part of that. When you go dancing and you're not wiggling in front of somebody, touch comes online. And your body and brain are so sensitive to the fact that there is now non-exploitive skin-on-skin contact that it just goes, yippee! And it actually shows up in the numbers. So dancing has a trifecta associated with it, so you can think of it as a magic bullet and any metaphor you like. Actually, it's a stool with 3 legs on it. Number one, it's exercise. Number two, it's a social interaction. And number three, for God's sakes, you're being touched now, and you're not being invisible because you have to dance with somebody.
And eat a Mediterranean diet when you have a break, I guess.
That's right. And every 6 months have some ribs.
All right. I've had Don holding on. He wanted to talk back when we were talking about science, and I can't let him hang on any longer if he's still there. Don, you there? What can we do for you?
Yes, sir. I'm here. Dr. Nadia has been using it, but he has not come out and said it. One of the best methods you've got is, especially in teaching, is to maintain a good sense of humor. As somebody used to teach driver's ed, I can assure you that is invaluable, because one of the first things I did when I got my students in the car, I wanted to know who was interested in history, who was a mathematician, who wanted science, you know, who was the auto mechanic, so I could take whatever knowledge I could share with them and relate to them and apply it to the course and the stuff that we were going through. And I think what you've got here going right now is just terrific. I think we need a lot more of it.
Thank you very much for your comments, Don. Dr. Medina.
Well, you know, there's something in the research literature which just goes to that. In the book on socialization, we also then start talking about things you can do for your mind that can keep things up and running. And one of the biggest is just start teaching people, particularly if you can teach people in an intergenerational setting. So just like the caller was saying, Thad, you know, if he's teaching younger people, not only are you going to be laughing, you're probably going to be learning a whole lot because they don't have the same perspective with you as you. And the literature is really clear about this. If you can regularly be teaching people that don't know what you know, and then listen to them as they respond so that it's not just a lecture, but you're also actually entering into a conversation, into a dialogue, even though you are teaching them, that actually produces changes in memory and processing speed as you get older. So, yeah, one of the biggest things you can do is eat, dance, and then go teach somebody something, okay?
Well, yeah, and certainly listening to you both on this program and when I heard you interviewed by Ginger Campbell on Brain Science Podcast, you're an upbeat, positive guy. And when you read this book, it's emotionally stimulating. So I got to say, although you didn't mention it, you do that as well. So
well, thank you
very much. What another place I've been skeptical and open-minded, however, is the mindfulness stuff that's coming out. And it's another area you touched on. You want to comment on that? We're in our last 7 or 8 minutes, by the way.
Sure. I certainly share your skepticism. When I think of mindfulness, I think of meditation practices and yoga and lots of things. Lots of stuff that isn't, lots of experiences that don't have controllable variables. And for the most part, that's still true, Thad. It's good to stay skeptical, buddy. The research is not real strong, and one of the biggest is that there are so many different styles of meditation and so many different practices that finding out a very particular behavior suite that you repeat and then do over and over again so that you can measure it has been bereft in many of these things. And so when you read that literature, sometimes it gets published, you just sit there and roll your eyes because you're thinking, well, what about this? What about this? What about this? In fact, for mindfulness in particular, I've actually seen, we were talking about on the break, that I've actually seen books called Mindfulness for Dogs, Mindfulness for Cats. So we're not going to do that. Instead, we're going to go to, this is the work of Dave Creswell at the University of Pittsburgh, and most particularly, the Teasdale variant of Jon Kabat-Zinn's great work on mindfulness, whereby Teasdale in particular, this is a book you can actually buy. It's the research instrument of how to do mindfulness. It's an 8-week course you have to undergo in order to get it right. But that 8-week protocol has been studied extensively. And when you do that and start doing real-life randomized blinded trials, you see some amazing things. So if you're willing to do the 8-week mindfulness course, you will start to sleep better. Probably because of the second biochemical, and that is you lowered your cortisol levels. Cortisol is a glucocorticoid. It's a stress hormone, as you know. And when you are doing mindfulness training, you begin to lower your cortisol levels, and that now you begin to sleep better. Mindfulness seniors show marked reductions in depression and anxiety as a result of the course. And one of the biggest reasons is that they report ruminating less frequently over negative things in their life at night. You might know, and maybe you do this, or maybe you have listeners who do, you go to sleep and you immediately start calling up all the things that you're worried about. And when you're worried about them and you stay worried about them, then the stress hormones go up and then you're not sleeping very well, and pretty soon depression and anxiety are knocking on your door. When you do mindfulness training, mindfulness will teach you how to break the rumination cycle and get started on something better. One of the most interesting parts of it, though, has to do with the vascular health and then the cognitive health that comes with certain types of mindfulness. Mindful seniors are 86% more likely to score in the positive range for markers of cardiovascular health than those who aren't practicing it. So it's actually doing your heart much better if you do mindfulness training, the 8-week protocol. And here's the biggie. Something that we call attentional blink times improve by about 30%. Now, that was a stunner for us. The attentional blink is the time it takes for you to switch between tasks, okay? It takes you about half a second on average, but only if you're young. When you get older, you don't switch between tasks as readily unless you're doing mindfulness training. It's not a magic bullet. The mindfulness won't do everything. It's not going to substitute for olive oil. Nonetheless, it's extraordinarily important, and it's a great example of how, when we were talking about how science works, if you're willing to be scientific about it, to have a rigor, in this particular case, the 8-week protocol of mindfulness, you can actually measure what it works. And what it works is very powerfully. One of the biggest also we didn't talk about is that it also changes that executive function we were talking about. But there you are. Yeah.
Last 4 minutes, I got two emails that get to very good science critical thinking questions, and they're looking at issues like confounding variables. Is the diet really helpful around the Mediterranean because they exercise more? Have we control for that? And the other question is, let me get to it, social interaction. Maybe people who socialize more because they have better cognitive function, and that's why they're socializing. So the issue is there's always these confounding variables we got to control for. What's the answers?
Absolutely. When you're talking about socialization, we do that second one first. We're actually talking about chicken and egg questions. Chicken and egg questions are always a confounder in this, and you have to be very, very careful for it. You can control for them, for sure, by finding people that are not doing it and make sure they don't do it for the time you're testing. And that's also true with both the exercisers and the Mediterranean diet. You can actually control for whether they're doing an exercise or not doing an exercise and just take a look specifically at the diet itself. That's extremely expensive work to do. It took a long time to get it published. I think it was first published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and even then it was over a long period of time. But you can show that it is, the Mediterranean diet is the necessary and sufficient condition to start getting the changes in working memory. And if you add exercise to it, all you're doing is boosting the scores that you see rather than creating the scores that you see. So we have tools available for chicken and egg type of work, and we also have tools for being able to look for confounding variables. And may I say, that is a terrific question.
All right. We got just a couple of minutes left. This is the time where I would like you to sum up what we want to make sure our listeners have heard today that's important.
I think one of the biggest things is that we're talking over and over again about doing things you can do with friends. So you can eat the right food, but you can do it with friends. You can go dancing, but you can do it with friends. You can take a class together and teach together, and you do it with friends. And finally, you can get ticked off at somebody and argue with them, but do it as friends. So what we're seeing continually, and even exercise together, I think if I were to give any central gravity to any of the things that the book has said, it's really, really simple. Go out and have a friend. Go out and be a friend and interact with them all the time, right until the time you die.
It's been a real pleasure. I have to say that I wish everybody would take advantage of and get your book. I don't say this lightly, Brain Rules for Aging Well, which is multi-generational. It works for young. It works for old. We haven't said that. It's not just for people like me. It's got great...
Well, remember, if it's all over by age 30,
that's a good point.
Anybody over age 30, that book is for.
Good point. I think you should get it. It's a fun read. It's very easy to read. He's a great writer, and just like listening to him, he's enjoyable. You won't regret getting Brain Rules for Aging Well. Thanks very much for taking the time with us, Dr. Medina.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I enjoyed myself immensely.
It's been a pleasure. So my thanks to John Medina, the author of Brain Rules for Aging Well, for being with us today. And if you want to continue the conversation, you can join us on KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the tab for Line 1. You can see our archives. You can see our resources for today's program, including a number of important links. Next week, Line 1 will be hosted by Prentice Pimpernan, and just in time for Valentine's Day, the topic is Love 2.0, which is about the importance of socialization on health, partly reminiscent of what was discussed today. So why not join him and learn a little bit more on Monday, February 12th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. I always want to thank Dave Waldron, who engineers most of our programs. Eric Bork is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.